This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the third week of August, and this week, Kabul fell to the Taliban. And while this was expected to happen eventually, the U.S. government was clearly caught off guard by the speed, which resulted essentially from the Afghan military choosing not to fight. Now we are in the process of a mass evacuation amid mass chaos. At the start of the week, there were as many as 15,000 American citizens in Afghanistan. We don't know the exact number, plus citizens of allied countries. And obviously, the number of Afghans who would like to leave the country is very large. That includes tens of thousands who are likely eligible for special immigrant visas due to their work for the U.S. during the two-decade-long war. But processing those visas has been challenging, and most of those who would qualify to come here don't have the right paperwork. The result is chaos, with Afghans desperately seeking entry to the U.S.-controlled Kabul airport, and some Americans having trouble getting into the airport because of this chaos. We're supposed to complete our withdrawal by the end of the month, but it's not obvious the evacuations can finish by then. And of course, who knows what will happen with the detente that exists now between the Taliban and U.S. forces. To talk about that, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Megan McArdle, columnist at the Washington Post, on the right. Hello, Megan.
Hi, Josh.
And on the left, Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. Hello, Liz.
Hi, Josh.
Our special guest for today's show is Paul D. Miller. Paul was a member of the National Security Council staff for 2 years, spanning the George W. Bush and Barack Obama administrations as director for Afghanistan and Pakistan. Before that, he was an intelligence analyst for the CIA and a military intelligence officer in the U.S. Army. He served in the war in Afghanistan. Now he is a professor at Georgetown's School of Foreign Service and a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you for being here. So I don't normally do a roadmap for the show like this, but I want to lay out how I want to go through this conversation. We're going to spend the whole show on Afghanistan, and the show is in three segments. In the first segment, I want to talk about how we got here, why this war continued so long, what we were trying to achieve in Afghanistan, and how it is that over 20 years and over $1 trillion did not produce an Afghan regime that could stand on its own, even for a few weeks. In the second segment, we'll talk about the withdrawal. Was there a better way to withdraw with less risk to American personnel and more evacuations of vulnerable Afghans? And do the events of the last week show that we should not have withdrawn at all? In the third segment, we'll talk about what we should do now. But let's start with how we got here. Paul, after the initial phase of this war where we dislodged the Taliban from power, what was our objective in Afghanistan?
The objective going in, and I think the objective all along, was to destroy al-Qaeda as much as we could, and then deny safe haven to al-Qaeda and its copycats indefinitely. And that's the real catch. It was relatively easy to go after al-Qaeda's foot soldiers and most of its senior leadership in short order. But denying safe haven means not allowing them to come back after we leave. If we'd gone in there for a couple of months, killed some bad guys and left, we all know what would have happened. Taliban could have come back quite easily, and al-Qaeda could have reconstituted its safe haven quite easily. That's precisely why we had to stay and try to build something that could deny safe haven after we left. And that was the harder part of the conflict, the one that kept us there so long and the one that we ultimately failed at.
Was it your expectation? You must have been at the National Security Council in 2008, 2009. Did you expect we'd still be engaged in this military operation in 2021?
That depends upon the choices that President Obama was about to make. I could envision us being there for a very long time if we settled on, as we did, a strategy of forever war. What I advocated for and what we didn't do was a strategy of more fully resourced counterinsurgency and state building, which I thought would have been the strategy for actually bringing this war to a more successful and definitive conclusion. Actually building Afghan state capacity, actually building infrastructure, roads, schools, and hospitals, so that the Afghans could stand on their own 2 feet after we left. President Obama and President Trump and President Biden essentially said no to that strategy. President Obama cut civilian reconstruction assistance every year after 2010, and he very clearly said he didn't want to resource state building. President Trump, even more so, said the same thing. Because they said that, all they settled into was a never-ending campaign of whack-a-mole against terrorists. If that's our strategy, then yeah, I totally expect it to last forever because there's no end to it. I don't think that's an optimal strategy, but I do think it's better than what we did the last week.
Wait, so didn't we spend tens of billions of dollars over this period on state building? What would a successful program like that look? Because, I mean, we've seen, you know, the Afghan government obviously has not been an ideal partner in this. Is there an amount of money that we could have thrown at that and that would have been a successful project?
Yeah. So I would love, thank you so much for giving me a chance to address this myth, the myth that we spent 20 years nation building in Afghanistan. Right. So we didn't do that. For the first 5 or 6 years that we were in Afghanistan, we were there doing counterterrorism operations. We were whacking bad guys. The United Nations and some of their allies tried to do some state building here and there, but not at scale. And it was poorly coordinated. It was wasteful. We missed a window of opportunity. We did a little bit of help with their elections. That was the most we ever did in state building during this time frame. For a narrow window from about 2007 to 2011, we dumped a lot of money on Afghanistan. We tried to do some genuine state building. It was rushed. It was, again, wasteful. A lot of it was siphoned off in corruption. But again, I think it was probably the right thing to try if we had been more patient, more steady, and more deliberate in how we did it. After 2011, we gave up. And for the past 10 years, we've really done almost nothing in the way of state building, of, again, building infrastructure, roads, schools, and hospitals. We've just been killing terrorists. So you're asking me, could we have done better? Yeah, we could have started earlier. We could have been more persistent, more patient. And instead of panicking and dumping money on the country all of a sudden, we could have maybe parceled it out more steadily. And that might have had more lasting results.
Megan, in the immediate aftermath of the September 11 attacks, you were working on the reconstruction or the cleanup of the World Trade Center site.
I was.
I'm wondering how you have looked at this war over the last 20 years from, you know, from being up close to the aftermath of the attacks, as you have watched the war evolve over that period. What have you made of our choice to go in and to stay and now to leave?
Well, I supported going in like 90% of Americans. I don't think that there was realistically any chance that we weren't going to. I think you also have to sort of take that argument about the United States is it is human nature if someone kills a bunch of Americans to go and try to hit that person harder than you got hit. You know, I lost people on 9/11. I grew up in New York City. I knew one guy who missed work and probably would have died if he hadn't. You know, those stories, they stay with you. And I think all of America was in terrible shock. I think that it is unfortunate that that shock got channeled into Iraq, because I think that we took our eye off the ball in Afghanistan, and it's possible maybe that we could have done more if we had actually put the effort into it, not necessarily in terms of, you know, turning them into a modern liberal democracy, a project that I'm deeply skeptical on about on multiple levels. But just in terms of, you know, kind of doing economic development more thoughtfully, building more infrastructure, you know, but there's also limits. We were, you know, pouring 50, 100% of Afghan GDP into the country, and there's a limit to how much the country can absorb. And I think one big problem with both this and Iraq is that we went into those places with a mental model of Japan or Germany. But Japan and Germany had just economically, I mean, leave aside, you know, the fact that they were states, that they had already done, regardless of democracy, they had done a lot of the work of nation building and state building, which is really complicated. And we sort of lose sight of that. It's the 19th century, you know, nationalism, for understandable reason, gets a bad rap. But actually, it's really hard to make people into a nation. That is actually a lot of hard work. It took a lot of work in Greece and Germany and all sorts of places to say, look, we have these linguistic commonalities, although less than you would think. Actually, these dialects were not, you know, people thought of them as kind of more separate than we now do. But also that we have all of these cultural commonalities and we're a country. That work had never really been done in Afghanistan. It's a deeply tribal place, which is kind of a more natural form of human organization than the nation. And it takes a lot of work. It takes decades. It's patient work. And similarly, economically, you know, Germany and Japan, they already had fairly modern industrial economies that we, you know, yes, the actual physical plant had been destroyed, but the ways of being in industrializing workers takes decades. It's really hard to teach people to work in factories and do all of that sort of thing. All of that work had already been done. And so we were going in and fiddling around a lot of the edges. In Afghanistan, it's a much deeper project. And I think that, you know, I certainly at the time did not appreciate how big a project it was and how unlikely we were to succeed in the way that we were envisioning. Because when Americans go in, we don't do this thing of like, well, we're just going in to kick some butt and teach them a lesson, and then we're withdrawing. We need it to be about democracy and freedom and all of these great ideals. But I think we overreached from our own kind of natural human and cultural tendencies in ways that were predictable and maybe not avoidable, but tragic for both us and I think for Afghanistan.
Liz, what lessons do you draw from what we've seen in the last month? Does this shake your view at all that getting out was the right thing?
No. And nor does it shake my view that going in was the wrong thing. I was just a child when all of this began. The majority of my life, we've been in Afghanistan. I'm 30 years old now. I was 10 when this all started. I can remember 9/11 happening. Of course, we lived in Texas. I'd never heard of the World Trade Center before, didn't know what it was. That was fairly common where I was from. And it was horrible. I mean, everybody was extremely distressed, as Megan said. And there was, of course, a lot of automatic saber rattling. And I think you could have gotten at that point probably most of the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex to agree to wage war on anybody you wanted. As I got older and became more aware, you know, aged into my teenage years, we were still doing this. It was still new. Bush was, you know, going out of office and Obama was being elected. And there was this question of what was going to happen with Iraq and Afghanistan. And it seemed pretty obvious to me that just on the face of it, how did 9/11 happen? Well, some guys got some laptops and they planned to get some guys trained in how to fly planes and then get them on commercial airliners with box cutters. That's how 9/11 happened. And I thought to myself, even at the time, so we're going to prevent that from happening with an army? What are we going to do? Bomb all their laptops? I mean, the problem is that people want to do this. And if they want to do it, they'll find a way. And it seems like all we're going to do is create a lot of really, 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 really ill will toward the West and lose. And in fact, that seems to be exactly what happened. Only this time, we also gave them a bunch of free weapons from the West.
Yeah, I'd love to address some of that. It's not a couple of guys with laptops. It's a network. It's the fact that these guys were able to gather together in one place, train together, talk together, plan together, and draw motivation from each other. They radicalize each other by gathering together and forming these relationships. That's what we attacked when we went in to destroy Al-Qaeda's training camps in Afghanistan. And that's what they can reconstitute today, now that we've left and handed the country over to the Taliban. That's why it's worth attacking the Taliban in the first place. And that's why I'm afraid Al-Qaeda will reconstitute itself again.
Yes, but what was the future ever going to be where they were not going to be able to talk to each other again? Were we going to genocide them? I mean, what was the end game where devout Muslims were not going to be able to get together and talk about the West?
Well, there has been disruption of that over the last 20 years.
Yes, but it was always going to end when we pulled out. Was this going to be a permanent occupation?
No, that's the president's argument. He says that it was inevitable that this had to happen, that it was always going to end this way. And that is a transparent effort on his part to evade responsibility for the consequences of his choice to pull the plug. I'd love to stress that Afghanistan had reached a roughly sustainable state prior to the pullout. I'm not going to defend the strategy. There was things we could have done to improve it. But prior to the pullout, the Afghan army stood and fought. They fought for 10 years. They lost 55,000 troops in combat against the Taliban. That says to me they were improving. They were ready to defend their country. They were doing so as long as we were standing by them, giving them the resources they needed to win their fight. And they had been making progress over the course of 10, 15 years. So that says to me, this could have evolved differently. It was not inevitable that they collapsed as they did. It was not inevitable that we had the chaos that we saw last weekend. Again, it's very disingenuous for the president to claim it was always going to end this way. That is not true. It could have ended much differently.
Here, that gives us a good turn. Let's take a break here, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about what the alternatives to this withdrawal were. I've been talking with Megan McArdle of The Washington Post, Liz Bruning of The Atlantic, and Paul Miller of The Atlantic Council. This is Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our Left, Right, and Center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, columnist for Insider. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist for The Washington Post. On the left is Liz Bruning, staff writer for The Atlantic. And our special guest today is Paul D. Miller, professor at Georgetown School of Foreign Service and a senior fellow with The Atlantic Council. So I want to talk about what happened over the last few weeks and what could have been done differently. And sort of I see two different sets of alternatives. One is, what if we had stayed indefinitely? And the other is there a different way that we could have withdrawn that would have been more successful? And so let's start with the case for staying. And so, Paul, you were saying before the break that we were at a roughly stable equilibrium in Afghanistan, not necessarily a really good one, but one that could continue on an ongoing basis. Now, my understanding is that since February 2020, we've had this agreement with the Taliban that we are supposed to withdraw. And that is part of the reason that that our military action there has calmed down. We haven't had U.S. deaths in quite some time. But the Taliban is expecting us out of there by the end of the month. And so suppose the Biden administration had gone and said, actually, we're not going to withdraw. I assume that changes the situation on the ground there, that we need to send in more troops, that they will be engaged in more conflict with the Taliban because they are now deciding that we're not actually going to leave. So what is an ongoing military operation there look like if we had decided not to leave?
So the relative stability that I'm talking about dates not to February 2020, but all the way back to the end of 2014. The United States, the international coalition, handed leadership to the Afghans for security in their country. We were in a supporting role. We were only doing a train, advise, assist mission and providing them air support and air cover. U.S. troops were largely not in harm's way, not engaged in ground combat in large numbers against the Taliban, and only 66 U.S. servicemen were killed in action over the past 7 years. I say that not to make light of the 66, but to give you some historical perspective, this was not a large conflict for the United States. We had come to a place where it was sustainable for us well before the February 2020 peace deal that Trump signed.
So am I scoping this correctly, though? I understand that the deaths have been quite limited for a number of years, but we're spending ballpark, $40 billion a year on this operation. Up until the last couple of years, it was something like 10,000 troops in the country. And that air support you're describing, that means that we're bombing a lot of things, right? And so that's, obviously the Taliban coming in is not great for the population of Afghanistan, but the operations we were engaged in were very disruptive, in many cases killing civilians. That's the thing that we would have been doing ongoing?
It depends upon how the situation evolves on the ground. My point is that the Biden administration's claim that it was unsustainable and that stability dates to February 2020, that's not true. We had achieved that kind of rough stability much earlier than that. What it would look like going forward, it's hard. Nobody has a crystal ball. We can't say for certain what it looks like. I would have advocated for maybe a slightly larger presence to accelerate and strengthen the train, advise, assist mission, and maybe to give more support to the rural counterinsurgency strategy, which was the missing piece of the puzzle, in my view. That might have led to a more gradual transition. No, you know what it might have led to is restarting negotiations from a stronger position. That, I think we all know, negotiations was the ultimate sort of end state we're going for. But the negotiations that Trump undertook was not a negotiation, it was a surrender. He agreed to withdraw and demanded nothing verifiable in return from the Taliban. So I would like to have thrown that out. I'd like to see the new administration launch new negotiations while sustaining a military presence that's kept the Afghan army in the field. That would have been a defensible way forward. I don't know how long that takes. You know, you said, is this open-ended? Is it indefinite? Other people have said, what's the timeline? Wars aren't fought on timelines. You know, we got into World War II. There was no timeline. It was open-ended. It was an indefinite commitment to fight the war and win and secure our interests. So people ask me, do you advocate staying there indefinitely? I want to turn that around and say, do you advocate fighting wars on timetables, which no military strategist ever has recommended doing? That's not a way to fight an effective war.
Liz, I think it's literally true that what Paul describes there is sustainable. We could have kept doing it. We could afford it. We have the military personnel in order to do it. It's something that we'd gone on doing for so many years because it was possible to continue doing it. And Paul also points to some of the potential benefits from that what the risk that Al-Qaeda reconstitutes itself is reduced to the extent that we are there, with our military presence in Afghanistan. We have seen images on television of what is happening in Kabul, it's not necessarily the entirety of the country, but I think it's pretty clear that life is better for the people in Kabul, or was better under with our military there than with it gone. Do you find plausible the idea that passes cost benefit?
it depends on, I suppose, what values you weight, and that's how you run cost benefit analyses, by weighting certain values. What I would say is, if we're going to stay indefinitely, you just make an honest woman out of Afghanistan. Make them the 51st state, build them infrastructure, give them votes in our elections, and just admit what you're doing. They're conquered and now occupied and now annexed territory. It's ridiculous to have an indefinite American presence, not only situated on military bases, as in Germany or Okinawa or something, but actively involved in governance and policing and running the show. So we had American soldiers training Afghan security forces and then monitoring their activities and then participating in their activities, because Afghan security forces would regularly not do what we told them to do. I think this is most transparent in the whole pederasty problem that we tried to clear up and never did, right? That there are just cultural practices and activities that were persistent the entire time we were there. We were always trying to stop them or change them. We never succeeded, but we never stopped trying, right? So if that's going to be the case, then just say that we're trying to govern them.
Yeah, Megan brought up a similar point about Afghan culture, and that somehow we were trying to do something there that was going against the grain, against their culture, against who they are. And I would really love to push back against that. Where do I begin? The Afghan constitution is not something, we didn't write that, right? The Afghans wrote their constitution. When 2004 came around, they copied and pasted their 1964 constitution, which we didn't write. And they just substituted president for king. You know, there's a myth that we somehow foisted a democratic constitution on them. They had democratic elections in 1965 and 1969, well before this whole mess came about. When we talk about building institutions, capacity building, bureaucracy, that's not Western. We didn't Westernize the country by trying to build a functioning government. There's nothing Western about functioning institutions. The Afghans like their constitution. The Asia Foundation has surveys of the Afghan people they release every year, and their constitution is popular. Something like 90% of Afghans support majority rule, democratic institutions, representation. Even women's rights is pretty popular in Afghanistan. So there's nothing that we tried to do and force on them that they didn't actually want themselves, except for the Taliban, right? They're the ones who don't like it. It's always the sort of rich Sunni Pashtun men who don't like what we're doing, but the Hazaras, the Tajiks, the Shia, the women, they're wildly enthusiastic about democracy.
My point is a little narrower than that, which is that, you know, we talk a lot, right, in economic development about institutions, and I take a fairly broad view of what an institution is. And, you know, one silly example that I often give is, how do you stand in line, right? There's no kind of natural law that says standing in line is better than the rugby scrum that you find in many Asian countries. But it is a way of everyone kind of commonly understanding that this is how society works, and that if you don't line up and you're in a line standing country, then you are violating an actually important norm that kind of helps everything. Well, you know, showing up on time to a factory, that's not a natural human behavior. And in fact, if you look at economic development in America or in Britain or anywhere else, it actually takes a long time, like decades, to kind of build a cadre of workers who normally do that and consider that a normal part of life. Obviously, it's not some sort of thing that only Westerners can do. China had an extremely extensive bureaucracy in, you know, well, my ancestors were still running around painting themselves blue in Ireland. But that said, it is within the cultural context you're in, it does take a long time. And if you look at the history of China, it takes them a long time to build up the kind of administrative capacity they now have. But when Mao comes in, even though you do have periods of chaos, there is a cultural substrate there that you're building on, that you're reactivating. And Afghanistan doesn't have that. It's never had that kind of modern economy or modern government. It has never been governed as intensively as a big modern state. And that is hard work to build. And I don't think that I or many Americans appreciated, it's not that people don't like the idea of democracy or so forth, but I didn't appreciate how many cultural norms you need around respecting the results of elections, around, you know, well, as we saw in our own country, right, how fragile it is even here, but also around just things like how does the economy work, how do we tolerate corruption, you know, the ghost soldiers, all of the rest of it. Those things are, they're deep. We couldn't go in and eradicate them. And I think that that really constrained how much, how effective our efforts were going to be. And again, I think I at least was mentally comparing it to Japanese and German situations where local people had already done a ton of that work over the 19th century before we occupied them. And I didn't appreciate that distinction.
I just don't understand. If 90% of Afghans are eager for democracy, I don't understand how the Taliban has swept back to power. I mean, I think that has to reveal a significant lack of popular support for the government that they had that we had brought back to power. I think in part because it has been so corrupt and incompetent.
People can support the Constitution and reject Ashraf Ghani for his corruption. Those things can both be true. And people don't want to fight and die for Ashraf Ghani, maybe, especially if they think it's a suicide mission when they don't have American support. They can like the idea of democracy and yet feel powerless to defend it when men with guns march into their city and say, we're in charge now, especially if
they
promise
not
to
also
put an
have
end to the
guns?
Corruption.
I mean, we armed them, right? That's why they are now rich with weapons given to them by the West that they can now sell to China or Russia or anyone else they want, right? I mean,
we
armed them.
We're talking about Afghan civilians, not the Afghan army.
Right. But if the Afghan army was as hot and crazy for American-style liberal democracy as is being suggested, what gives?
And is what, four outnumbers the Taliban forces by about four times and is better right. armed? It seems
300,000 people?
Yeah. It says something remarkable to me that they...
Well, I think they didn't actually have the 300,000. A lot of them were fake.
That's right. And okay, so let me paint the picture for you of what it looked like on the ground, you know, out in the provinces this spring. They did not... I don't think they did outnumber the Taliban, say, in Lashkar Gah or in Ghor province or something, right? They're out there in the periphery, out in the kind of the badlands, and suddenly they hear that the American president says, we're going home. We're taking away your air support. You're on your own. Good luck. The Afghan soldiers, yes, I think even if they liked the Afghan constitution and they liked the principle of democracy, they don't want to commit suicide. They don't want to go in a fight a losing battle, a suicide quest to fight a battle they think they can't win because suddenly the medevac isn't there, the logistics aren't there, the close air support's not there. And they made a rational decision, hey, I'm going to go be with my family. And the Taliban are going to come in. Maybe I can get out. Maybe I can just hunker down. Yeah, right?
That's
a rational decision for them to make.
No matter how well armed they are. No, that's called not really wanting democracy all that bad.
No, it means they want to live.
I want to turn and talk about one thing before we go to the next break, which is Paul has made a case for staying. The other counterfactual I want to talk about is there a better way we could have left on approximately this timeline? And this is the criticism that you see from former President Trump, who was nominally committed to this withdrawal, although he didn't manage to complete it during his 4 years in office, basically saying that we did this in the wrong order, that you have to pull the military out last after you've done these evacuations, you have to destroy the equipment. Is there, Paul, is there a better timeline that we could have done that, you know, I realized that the Taliban would come back to power and you've laid out all the reasons why that's a cost not worth bearing. But could we have avoided some of these other issues? Could we have gotten the American citizens who were on the ground out? Could we have gotten more of the Afghans out with a somewhat different order of operations here?
I think the answer is yes. So if we assume, if we just take for granted that Trump signed the deal and Biden was going to implement it, I think still we could have seen better planning. And the fault for that lies, I'd say, three quarters with Trump and one quarter with Biden, because Trump was president during most of the time when the peace deal was in place, most of the time when the U.S. government should have been planning and carrying out these evacuations, and Biden came in and only had a few months, right? So ideally, the U.S. government would have been planning these evacuations, processing the visas, cutting the red tape, prioritizing categories of refugees as soon as the ink on that deal was dry. And Trump quite clearly did not inject any sort of urgency into this process in his last year in office for whatever reason, you know, because of COVID, because of his own impeachment, on and on and on, because of the election. So there could have been a lot more planning. But I do want to blame the Biden administration for making its announcement public in April that it was going to withdraw before having any of these plans in place. I think it was deeply irresponsible for him to make that announcement, because that public announcement, that was the kind of the starting bell for the end. And the Taliban knew that they were going to win. And I think the Afghan army knew that they were going to lose. That's when you kind of saw the house of cards begin to collapse. I would have wanted to see all of the visa processing, the process itself to be worked out, and the American citizens to be evacuated or close to evacuated before you make that announcement. Once the announcement's made, it's almost too late already. But for us to get to this last weekend, and for 10,000 Americans still to be in country, is to me an astonishing dereliction of duty. I think Tony Blinken should not have a job after this. It is just amazing to me how badly the State Department has failed in its job of protecting Americans overseas, warning them of dangerous situations, prioritizing evacuations. I think the Defense Department has something to answer for. It's a catastrophe of the highest order. So the answer is yes, they could have planned better.
Is there a way to avoid announcing a withdrawal date in April? Because we were supposed to withdraw by May 1, and I assume there was an extension negotiated with the Taliban. Is it possible to reach those terms with the Taliban and keep secret when you're actually intending to leave? Or is it possible to negotiate that extension with the Taliban without setting a new date certain?
It's not clear to me that we did actually negotiate a settlement. I think what happened is the administration simply decided upon one, communicated it, and the Taliban sort of took what they could get, because again, they knew they were winning. All they had to do was wait and they were going to win. Could the Biden administration have? Yes, they could have. Biden could have sort of publicly repudiated the deal, started with the doing the evacuations. It might have gotten a little bit more violent, but you could have gotten a lot more people out of the country. And then maybe towards the end of the year, at the end of the fighting season, he could make an announcement, complete the withdrawal over the winter when typically there's much less violence there. Something like that could have avoided the chaos and the humiliation of this past weekend.
Liz, what have you made watching this? Because I see a number of areas for concern. One is, you know, I think it's still very unclear exactly how the whole evacuation is going to play out, but I'm concerned about the fate of Americans who remain in Afghanistan. It's our public policy that we're supposed to be admitting some tens of thousands of people from Afghanistan who are eligible for SIV visas, most of whom probably are not going to obtain those visas. And then also you have the risk that if things really go to hell, that you then have a reason why we need to re-escalate our military involvement. So I assume, you know,
as we have,
Biden has been right, exactly. But I mean, even on a more ongoing basis. But so, Liz, does all of that worry you at all? That, you know, that this might actually not truly get us out of Afghanistan in the end?
Yeah, and I mean, even if it gets us out of Afghanistan, the Afghan people are screwed. They're worse off. The people who we're bringing to the United States are going to be walking into an extremely tense political climate that is not particularly hospitable to them. I don't know if you've been online, if you've seen the responses to the images full of Afghan refugees, images of planes full of Afghan refugees. But there is your next few years of right-wing campaign material. And just as the anti-immigration stuff was pretty successful with Trump, I would think that whoever you're looking at next on the right is going to have a field day with the Democratic president who brought in hundreds upon hundreds upon thousands of Afghan refugees, especially if there are, as I suspect there will be, sooner rather than later, atrocities against Westerners in Afghanistan and down the line, some more pretty dazzling terrorist attacks, that will be very politically potent. And so if the Trump years were bad, I imagine that's just a prelude. So, I think that decisions were made in the United States about foreign policy, starting around the time of 9/11 and then ongoing for the next 20 years, that made it almost inevitable that we would wind up in a situation that is really, really, really bad geopolitically, domestically, and in a humanitarian sense. So yes, it's very worrying.
Megan, the line from the Biden administration is basically that there was no clean way to get out of here, that if you telegraph the departure farther in advance, then you're going to create chaos, maybe accelerate the fall of the government. I think another concern for them has to have been, obviously, that if you tried to do this mass evacuation earlier, it wouldn't just be the eligible Afghans trying to get out. It would be large numbers of them, as we're seeing now, and that would create additional, you create a migrant crisis that way. The administration being reluctant to admit error here, do you see an obvious way that this withdrawal could have been done a lot better?
I'm afraid I do see an administration that is reluctant to admit error. And I think that fundamentally what happened is that, as with so many, when people give us bad news, we don't like it. And we tend to discount the bad possibilities and play up the possibilities that tell us that we can do what we want to do. What Biden wanted to do was get out as quickly as possible, in part because there was some risk that something bad was going to happen. And he wanted that to be well away from his reelection in 2024, or Kamala Harris's reelection if he decides not to stand again. And so he wanted to, complete this as quickly as possible. I think that they just didn't think it was going to happen this quick. I mean, I think that their initial reaction was the truthful one, which is that they had people who were telling them this could happen. And they were like, yeah, whatever. Those guys always say bad stuff. Right. And then when it did happen, they were completely not prepared for it, which meant that they thought they had time. They thought they had time to get people out. They thought they had time, that the bad political optics, to the extent they occurred, would occur next year or the year after when Kabul fell. And that by then it would be kind of comfortably far removed from the withdrawal. And so I think that they didn't do what was kind of the obvious stuff. Get all the Americans out, make lists, where are they? Get them to the embassy, right? But at the end of the day, had we done it a little differently, had we been more prepared, had we gotten the State Department to get people out and process the visas. And again, I will say, look, they had a pandemic going on that is bound to shift the focus of the administration. But I think that was probably all the more reason to try to delay this further and not simply kind of announce in April that this was going to happen.
But before we go on to what to do now, Paul, I want to ask you about the intelligence here. Was it actually surprising to U.S. officials that Kabul fell so quickly? I mean, we've seen all these leaks over the last week of, assessments that said that this might happen. I never know what to make of that stuff because there's so much paper that comes out of so many different agencies, sometimes saying contradictory things. So you can always point after the fact to something that was correct in advance. But was there a sense that Kabul could fall this quickly? Were they really as surprised as they appear to have been by this turn of events?
There's a lot of finger pointing going on right now. The intelligence community wrote a paper last week. We knew years ago, 10 years ago, what might happen if we withdrew too soon. I could point to you stuff that I wrote. So it's not an intelligence failure when we knew it's coming from a mile away. The exact timing and sequence, of course, we don't know that because we don't have a crystal ball. The speed, I think even the Taliban were actually surprised by the speed with which they were able to push on the open door and walk right into Kabul and Kandahar and Herat. That, I chalk that up to the collapse in the Afghan army's morale triggered by Biden's announcement. Once they knew that they weren't going to have support, they laid down their weapons, the Taliban just walked on in. And yeah, that did surprise everybody, including the Taliban. But I don't really say that as an intelligence failure. I think that is a policy failure. It is a policymaker's mistake that caused that rapid collapse of the House of Cards.
Let's take a break and we'll come back and talk about what to do now. I've been talking with Megan McArdle of The Washington Post, Liz Brunig of The Atlantic, and Paul D. Miller of Georgetown School of Foreign Service. This is Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, columnist for Insider. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist for The Washington Post. On the left is Liz Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. And our special guest this week is Paul D. Miller, professor at Georgetown's School of Foreign Service and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. So here we are, and the mess in Kabul is ongoing, and our efforts to evacuate our personnel, our American citizens, and Afghans who are entitled to or maybe entitled to enter the United States, we're trying to get them out. So, Paul, what do you do now if you're running the U.S. government? What's the strategy given that this is the set of cards you hold?
Well, in the short term, of course, the priority is evacuations. And I think that that has to be, we have to have a laser focus on that until we get out every American citizen and as many Afghan refugees as humanly and physically possible. Beyond that, it's very hard to see what we can do. Our options are constrained because we just lost the war. And the enemies we fought for 20 years are back in power. Al-Qaeda is likely to reconstitute itself. And the United States has suffered an international public humiliation. Where do we go from here? I think within Afghanistan, we probably should try to reforge a partnership with the reconstituted Northern Alliance, the Panjshiri Tajiks. They are resisting the Taliban right now. I don't say that we should try to help them launch a civil war or a nationwide insurgency. That's not what I'm getting at. I do think that we need them as our eyes and ears on the ground. They're the only asset we might have to keep an eye on Al-Qaeda's reconstitution. And so some kind of partnership with them, I think, would be appropriate. More broadly, I'd like to see the international community consider longer term what to do about Afghanistan. When we pulled out of Iraq in 2011, we were pulled right back in 2014 to combat ISIS. I can envision a fairly similar scenario. I hope not, but I can envision a scenario where Afghanistan descends so badly, so quickly, or Al-Qaeda launches another attack, and it compels some kind of re-intervention by someone. If that happens, I really do think it has to be through the UN, should not be unilateral, and I think that we need to be ready to do that if necessary. And then beyond that, I've got other thoughts on how to deal with the United States' international position vis-a-vis Russia and China, but that's getting far out there.
Megan, we have this effort to issue visas to some tens of thousands of Afghans who are eligible based on their work with us during this 20-year war. But the number of people who would like to leave Afghanistan is much, much larger than that. And so you have this question of the moral responsibility and also the political, economic, and social sustainability of the size of migrant flows that you can take into the United States and Europe and other places that might receive people who are fleeing Afghanistan. And I think I've seen some sort of casual comments from both conservatives and liberals basically saying, let in the people who want to come here. And you can do that on some scale, but presumably not the scale that would meet the full demand, even assuming you could get that number of people out of Afghanistan. What is the extent of our responsibility here? And how many refugees should we be looking at taking at this time?
I think that's a really hard question. Like, I think the minimum is obviously anyone who worked with us in any capacity, or I would add did work that relied on a kind of security guarantee that we were implicitly providing. So journalists, for example, even if they weren't working, with a U.S. outlet, I think that those people put themselves on the line. They put themselves at risk because we encouraged them to do so. And that we have a moral obligation to make sure that risk does not end up being fatal for them, or to do as much as we can. And yet at the same time, we cannot literally take everyone in the world in who would be better off if they were in America, just politically, even if you think that morally we should. That's just not a tenable position. And I think that especially, I think in some ways the fact that we have had this ongoing crisis at the southern border is going to complicate this in a lot of ways. And I also think that the fact that the people like me who have been pro-immigration have been kind of happy in previous years prior to Trump, to kind of formulate a consensus that that's what we ought to do. And we and other people have these antediluvian ideas about the matter. So what we're going to do is just not really let them at the negotiating table because their ideas are stupid. And I think that that has backfired. And I actually think that for this particular humanitarian crisis, we would probably be in a better position to persuade people. I mean, I have been really surprised at the number of conservatives who just say to hell with any of them, even our interpreters, even et cetera. Right. You know, even the people in the Afghan special forces who fought next to our soldiers. If you had asked me 10 years ago if any conservative would be saying that America should just abandon those people, you know, I would say, well, no, conservatives are the party of national honor. Of course they wouldn't. Right. And it's been really shocking. And that is a lot of people dug into this really polarizing immigration issue. And I think that, that's going to have to be negotiated very sensitively. But I think that, you know, there are a lot of conservatives that I have been heartened to see, even though you do see people like Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham and so forth pushing on the, you know, don't let them in. They're just they're terrorists, whatever. That you've seen a lot of conservatives, even people who've been reasonably Trump friendly, pushing back on that. And I think that that's good. And I think that we have to take into account, even if we don't agree with them, we do have to take into account people's concerns and acknowledge that, yes, the United States does have a right to enforce its borders. But also say that, you know, with rights come obligations, as conservatives have always known. And one of the obligations that we have is to repay the trust that was placed in us rather than betraying it. And so at the very minimum, I think there are easily more than 100,000 Afghans, probably in the hundreds of thousands, who at a bare minimum we should be ready to take. And that is a number that America can absorb easily. You know, we have the space, we have the cultural capacity to integrate, assimilate, and take care of the people who took care of us in Afghanistan.
Liz, in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, we ended up taking in something like 700,000 refugees from, mm-hmm. from Vietnam, all told over a period of years, and additional refugees from Cambodia and other countries in the region. And it was never super popular with the public, but you had a bipartisan consensus behind doing it, and it basically made it possible to have that policy without it becoming too large a political liability for any political party, which is part of how it happened. I think the politics of that look very different today than they did in the 1970s. And I think we've also seen what happened in Europe over the last decade with the migrant flows there and the political disruption that you saw, especially to the mainstream left. And then one of the most successful left political parties you see right now in Europe is in Denmark, where this socialist government has taken a hard line on immigration and on migrants. And it's part of why they've been able to continue to sell a left political agenda in that country. And so I think Joe Biden looks at that with a certain amount of wariness as he looks at, you know, the prospect of both this, you know, this the large migrant crisis that is sure to result from this and the political prospects for him and his agenda in the United States. And I'm wondering about how you think about balancing that.
Yeah, I mean, there's no honor among thieves. So even though going into Afghanistan was absolutely a bipartisan affair, with the honorable exception of Barbara Lee and a few other political dissidents who were on the fringes of the whole Iraq-Afghanistan thing saying this is a bad idea, no one is going to claim absorbing the refugees because that would be owning the failure, right? If the Republicans came out and said, look, these people stood beside us, they fought with us, they tried to do what we told them to do, they believed us when they said when we said we could help them, and now they're royally screwed, that would be owning the now they're royally screwed. And the Republicans would like to fob that off on Biden, which is what you already see happening. Biden is going with this was always inevitable, and a lot of it I inherited from my Republican predecessors, such as Trump, who started initiating the pullout. And so, again, it's hard to own that now these people are royally screwed. And if he does, it's going to be under the aegis of, you know, sort of typical Democratic compassion for refugees who are displaced by conflict. But the right has had a field day with that over the past 5 years. And Biden has to know that, right? I mean, there's a reason that Hungary is of special interest to the right now. And I believe a huge part of it is the hard line Orban has taken towards refugees in Hungary. And so I don't know what's going to happen politically there. I don't think it's going to be anywhere near as smooth as the introduction of refugees from Vietnam was. Actually, where I'm from in North Texas has one of the highest concentrations of Vietnamese people in the United States because there was a huge amount of refugee resettlement in our area, and same in Houston. And it's totally fine. It's completely normal part of the landscape now, and it's part of what makes Texas a fantastic place to live. But I would say this is not going to go that way because the landscape has shifted so much that neither party is going to want to inherit that debt. And no matter what happens with Biden, the right is going to absolutely savage him and the Democrats for it. So I'd say they're between a hell of a rock and a hard place. And of course, the people who are ultimately going to pay are the Afghans who trusted us.
Paul, do you agree with that analysis?
The one additional bit of analysis I might offer is this. The right doesn't have to play the nativism card because they can just hold up images of Kabul, of the humiliation, of the evacuation of the embassy, the mobs in the airport. That'll be enough of a stick to beat Biden with. And they don't even have to bring up the immigration, the refugees, the nativism issue. My hope is they don't. I'm probably being naive, but if I was advising a Republican candidate, that's what I would tell him. I'd say, stay away from nativism, but just hammer on the catastrophe in Kabul and how incompetent it was to withdraw the way we withdrew. And that's enough. And perhaps that'll be all the political benefit they can get out of it.
That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Megan McArdle, Liz Brunig, and Paul D. Miller. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Jenna Cagle and Sarah Fay. Our production fellow is Nisha Venkat. The show is recorded and mixed by Desmond Taylor, and Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more of Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.